Welcome to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
And it's great to have your company for Tobin Brothers Celebrating Lives for our second season. Hope you're enjoying it, extending the show over an hour. Catch us every Sunday here on SEN this summer with some of the greats of our sport, and we have some of the biggest names in sport. And speaking of big, everything about him is big, including his playing career. He is one of the greats of Australian basketball. His name is Chris Anstey. Chris, good to have you along.
Thanks for having me, Pete.
It is good to see you, but we could be talking about a very different sport. Now, naturally, we see your stature and we think, well, probably basketball was going to be your thing from the word go, but we could very well be sitting here talking about a very promising tennis career.
Yeah, look, I did play when I was young and was okay. We were ranked, when I say we, I grew up with Dustin Fletcher, and he was my doubles partner. We were ranked quite high as a doubles pair, and individually we both went okay playing singles as well, but I think we both came to the realisation, 16, 17 years of old, that as good as we were, we'd probably tapped out and or maxed out, and we weren't going to get as good as some of these other kids who were going past us. So, I think the progression of football was really natural for Dustin with his family history and his dad being a captain of the club. But for me, I suppose it was a brand new sport. I went and filled in for my little brother at Keilor Basketball Stadium one night and happened to be seen by a scout from the Melbourne Tigers in what was, in my mind, the only game of basketball I'd ever planned on playing. So it's amazing where life can take you. It's, I still played tennis for another 3 months after that, but for some reason went down to a training session and turned out that I loved it, and I love being a part of a team. And honestly, I love being a part of an environment where height was really, really valued instead of something that was different and probably a bit of a negative. So there was a lot of appeal to playing the sport and coming in late to it. No bad habits, nothing ingrained that they had to change, and I was just a clean slate, and it was a lot of fun.
You talk about height not being recognised as an advantage in tennis, but you look at the likes of Ivo Karlovic and the serve that he's got at the moment, which is his weapon, because he gets such angle on the serve because he's 6'10". Was that something that you had?
Yeah,
Did you have a big serve?
But when they were able to get it back, I was screwed. So, I did. But, I mean, as much as anything, it's the height you get off your serve, and you got to return and serve from over their shoulders, which takes away a lot of those baseliners, strengths, I suppose. But I think now that you get a little bit later on in life, you always think you're better than what you probably were when it happened. And we thought we were pretty good then. I think I was outstanding now. But, it probably wasn't an advantage, because as the game of tennis evolved, it got onto the hard courts. And, we grew up playing on porous as much as anything. And a lot of baseline rallies, which didn't really suit me too much.
You talked about Dustin Fletcher and your association with him, but you were also in the same age group, essentially, as Mark Philippoussis at the time.
Yeah, one above him. So he was always 1 year younger, and you go up in 2 year blocks when you play in most tournaments. So we grew up playing with Mark, and he was pretty special. And it's interesting with Mark. It's a lot of people will always say that he's really underachieved, and I guess if you knew Mark as a junior, he was very good, but I think he got every bit out of the ability he had. And for him to make a Wimbledon final and have some of the moments, beating, we all sat around the television and watched him beat Pete Sampras at the Australian Open and then lose to Woodford or Woodbridge the next round. But he did it tough. His childhood wasn't easy, and it's probably been reasonably well documented that he, probably didn't have the most supportive of parents or the nicest people. But, we saw some things as kids that we probably, we understood how hard it was on Mark, and he overcame a lot to get to where he got to. And if he decided to spend a little bit of money later on in life to enjoy it, then good on him, because his childhood was tough.
When you sat there watching him play those Grand Slam finals, did you ever let yourself wander in the mind and say, well, if I had a stuck at it, maybe that might be me out there?
Not really. I don't think we ever really believed we were that good. I think if it was ever going to be anything, we had another kid we grew up with named Stephen Huss who became a Wimbledon doubles winner. So we just add him to the list of Wimbledon champions we've beaten. But for us, it probably was always going to look more like that we never thought we were that good as singles players. But the sum of the parts as a doubles pair was actually better than what we were. And Dustin's long and lean and athletic, and I nearly said as well, he's probably a lot more athletic than me, but No, we went well together, and we just got each other. We played for a lot of years, and yeah, who knows? Maybe he's only got a couple of weeks of footy left. I might have to call him up and go and find a Masters tennis tournament somewhere and just go and have a hit for some fun.
You talked about that game at Keilor and the fact that all of a sudden that changed your sporting direction, changed your life, basically. Do you ever wonder about what would have happened had you not actually been invited onto the court if the team hadn't been one short?
I really haven't let myself go there. I mean, I was ready to, just starting university. This was at the end of year 12. I was ready to go into university. And even when I started playing basketball, the agreement I had with my parents was that I'd continue to play as long as it seemed feasible, that I'd continue to get better and actually had a future. If we figured out within a year that I was actually no good, then I'd, straight back into university and continue studying. But look, it's... I tell kids all the time, it's just amazing where your next opportunity comes from. And, I probably had every right, or I suppose looking back, maybe I'm surprised I didn't, but I didn't really want to go. Turned up that night and stuffed around and, just jogged up and down the floor and passed time. But for some reason, I went and wanted to prove that even though I hadn't played the game, I was maybe still better than my brother or still better than the other people who were playing. And I suppose it's one thing I've always hated, isn't it? I just don't do losing well. It really bothers me. And even at that level, losing bothered me. And so turning up that night, I didn't want to lose and I didn't want to be out of my depth. And because of that, I tried. And I had an opportunity that gave me a 20-year basketball career.
So all of a sudden, one thing leads to another and you find yourself at the Melbourne Tigers and then the South East Melbourne Magic, and you were part of what was a glory era for the game in this country.
Yeah, one of my everlasting basketball memories was walking on to Rod Laver Arena for the first time, and there was a wooden floor on top of the tennis court. And I thought, what am I doing? It was surreal. I hadn't been in there when there was a basketball court on there. I'd only ever been in there to watch a tennis. I was in there every single year. And so to walk into this 15,000-seat stadium with a wooden basketball floor on top of the tennis court was weird. We'd had a couple of games. I hadn't played any. I used to wear tennis shoes because I knew I wasn't going to get put into the game. And, Lindsay had his rotations. And, the first time I set foot on the floor, I've got a photo of it still. I got a dunk in the first game I played. And, garbage time, last few minutes. But I remember walking on thinking, geez, I should have worn my basketball shoes. I've got a game and I got a dunk, and there's me dunking with ankle braces and tennis shoes. It's quite funny. But, it was a glory era. It was really exciting to be a part of, and I suppose I was a little bit spoiled because I knew no different because I didn't follow the sport before it. And that was my introduction to the sport, and it was amazing. And, there's a long conversation around what's gone wrong and what's beginning to go right again. But there's a really fantastic basketball following in this country, and they just need someone to hold their hand and drag them along and let them know that they're loved. And, we need to give them a club that there's some history and some heritage to. That's where the AFL wins over basketball, is that there's generations of support for clubs at a time. My family's been Western Bulldogs for four generations at least. There's not a team in Melbourne now that anyone could have supported for more than one season, because that's as long as it's been around for. So my hope, I'd love to see the Melbourne Tigers come back. That's the team that I started at. That's the team I feel a connection to. And there's a lot of past champions of that club who, no doubt, if they were able to come back now that it's been gone, would absolutely throw their weight, support, expertise behind it, and I think make sure that it worked. And I think that the basketball community would love to have that rivalry back in Victorian basketball again.
Bums on seats is a phrase that you hear a lot of in sport in general. When I've been to NBL games, it's a great experience. The fan is really involved in everything that goes on. Is it just a matter of getting that first-time person there to experience it once and to be bitten by the bug?
I think that's a big part of it. I think it's more expensive to go to the basketball than it is the footy. I always like to compare. I think we need to get down to charging something similar to a movie ticket price to get into the basketball. It's a two-hour event. There's a lot more that goes into it, but there are a lot of places, sports and entertainment, competing for our dollars. We're an expensive sport to walk in the door to. So yes, we need to get them in the door. And you saw last week, we opened the doors for free in basketball in Victoria, and 11,000 people turned up. Now, if we had have asked every single one of them for $60, I don't think we would have had 11,000 people turn up and watch. Now, that's an extreme, and you know, one of the things the AFL is struggling with that basketball does is the stadium deals. Our greatest cost as a sport are renting out Margaret Court Arena, Rod Laver Arena, Hisense Arena. If we want to play in those venues, we need to find a way to negotiate better deals and get ourselves in there at a price that we can afford to make money.
Is it possible to perhaps construct a boutique venue?
I would love to see it happen. And there have been a few rumours go around the old Footscray Market area, the Coles Myer site just off the southeastern freeway. There have been a few rumours. The State Basketball Centre holds 3,500 people out in Boronia. I'd love to see it happen. Whether or not it's realistic, again, there are smarter people out there than me to probably answer that.
Boronia might possibly be the downside for that, because a central location would be ideal if you could manage
public transport. It's in the absolute heartland of basketball in Victoria. It's amazing how many people play out there. So it's not it's probably not that as much as it is not having a train stop right on the front door. It's tricky to get to if you don't drive. And again, I still think you've got to come into Melbourne CBD. It's a sporting capital of the world. I think you've got to be a part of it.
We've talked about the game in the broad sense. When we come back after the break, we'll talk about some of your achievements in the game. Chris Anstey is our special guest on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers, celebrating lives.
Finley again finding Anstey. Knight closed out on him. Anstey just takes it right to the hoop. Sets up Anstey, and the Mavericks take the lead. Looks like Chris Anstey.
That shot. He won.
Oh, it's a 2-point goal. And Anstey has 20. Strickland on to Anstey. Chris Anstey's got 22. A new career high.
And finishing with 26 points back in 1998, at the time the highest by an Aussie in the NBA. Chris Anstey is our special guest on This Is Your Sporting Life. Chris, that was for Dallas, but you weren't drafted by Dallas.
I was drafted by Portland, and probably earlier than I expected. I hadn't really had that much interest outside of the Chicago Bulls. And I had a guarantee from them that if I was still around with the last pick of the first round, that they were going to draft me there. And that in itself was extraordinarily exciting, obviously, with the group that they had together, one of the best sporting teams of all time. And to have an opportunity to go there was amazing. And having said that, to get picked that early in an NBA draft after playing the sport for 4 years was something I certainly hadn't imagined, and I'd never spoken to anyone from Portland, so it was a bit of a surprise to see my name pop up. But no sooner had I put a Portland Trailblazers singlet on than I was ripping it off and putting a Dallas Mavericks singlet on. So it was a prearranged trade. Dallas was a team that had wanted me, and I had spent a little bit of time with them and had a wonderful 2 years in Dallas.
There hadn't been a lot of Aussies in the NBA at that stage. How were you treated when you first walked in there? Were you treated as something of a novelty?
Yeah, a little bit. It's funny with the NBA, and even back then, I think when a team doesn't draft someone out of college that their own fans are aware of, there's a sense of what the hell are you doing? And I certainly felt that, and I think you feel a responsibility to prove that you can play. And it's a really, really tough step to take. I mean, I went from being clearly the tallest guy on the team of the Southeast Melbourne Magic to the fourth tallest guy on their team, needing to get a lot stronger, needing to get faster, and a really, really average basketball player. And it was really apparent that I had to improve a lot really quickly. And I certainly think I did that. But look, it's a whole other level over there. They're the best athletes in the world. Every single person that walks into the locker room is an entity to himself. He's got a group of six mates telling him he's the best player in the world, trailing along, and very, very different sporting culture over there, and one where you have to be very self-sufficient and look out for yourself, because if you don't, there's not that many people with their hand down to pick you up if you fall. So you learn that pretty quickly.
When you first walked into the locker rooms or on the court with Dallas, did you look around and go, wow, what's a Melbourne boy doing here?
Yeah, a little bit, and I'd never thought about coming to Dallas or visiting. But as much as anything, it was just the how good everything was. I mean, you've got lounges in the change rooms, you've got plasmas in every locker room, you've got ice baths even back then in 1997, you've got a weight room off to the side. You know, we were driving across town to lift weights, then going somewhere else to run, and then going somewhere else to train, and everything you could, every resource you could possibly wish for was under one roof, and the best of the best. So it was surreal. And it's, you know, you travel, every time you go on the road, you drive in the back gate of the airport, you pull into the hangar, someone grabs your bag out of your car, you walk straight onto the plane, and you don't see it again until you're in a king suite at the Four Seasons, wherever you've gone. It's just, it's out of this world. And I think, probably something that I walked in day one and I had to sign my contract in the training facility, and they, my agent was sitting next to me and they said, does Chris need any money just to get himself settled and situated? And I thought, that's probably nice. I probably need a few $100 to go and get lunch today. And Leon, my agent, looked and he said, yeah, $250,000 might get it done. And they just didn't blink and they wrote me a check for $250,000. And I'm sitting here, that's more than I've ever made in my whole career playing, more than I probably thought I would. And that's just to walk out the door today, make sure I could go and get a car and get somewhere to live and do what you want with it. And and the deal was about $1 million a year. And I'm thinking, you guys are crazy. I would have done this for a fraction of this. But I was one of the lowest paid players on the team at that price. But for me, it's $1 million a year doing something you love doing.
Do you reckon you appreciated it more because of your background in the sport here and the fact that you had to go through lack of facilities and all that sort of thing as compared to the American guys? That's all I know. That's sort of standard.
Yeah, and that's it. And I didn't expect to be there. I didn't know how long I was going to last. And, for me, it was I certainly didn't live extravagantly. I made sure I sent it all home. I made sure I put it aside and I paid off my house. And I did a few other things that were, reasonably sensible investments. And, again, if you fall over and break your leg, you're not sure. You're never going to earn that again doing anything else. So, on the flip side of that, you'll see someone drive in with a $200,000 car wearing a $50,000 gold chain and they've just bought their mates, $8,000 suits, and it didn't make any sense to me. I guess in that regard, I was just different to what the stereotypical NBA player at the time over there was like.
So do you think those guys live in the real world, or is it just completely surreal do day to day?
No, it's surreal. And look, it depends on the person. I think when you do come across some people who are, I'd say normal, but maybe more like the way I've been brought up, it's really refreshing, and you can go and have meals with them, you can talk, and you can have a bit of a laugh about the whole thing. But it's really easy to get caught up in if you haven't got the right people making sure that you're not changing. And I had to say, I had a few mates. If you ever change or if you get an American accent, we'll be over there on the first plane and kicking your ass. So it's tricky.
Now, we can hear something in the background there. I'll come back to that in just a moment. But there's a little fella just crying in the background there.
Yeah, that's young Hunter. So I've got a young five-month-old. So I'm actually home for this week and next week as my wife goes back to work, and she's a special operations police officer, so she can't have a baby floating around the gun range this week. So he's over there. I thought he was asleep, but if anything you do well, it's tricky to get him to sleep.
I'll talk to you a little bit more about fatherhood later on, but let's continue with your NBA career. You moved from Dallas to the Windy City, Chicago. And I think, did you miss Michael Jordan by season?
I missed everyone with any ability by one season. that's a bit unfair. I had Tony Kukoc, I had Randy Brown, I had Dickie Simpkins, who were, I suppose, remnants of those championship teams. But just walking into that place, it's the most famous sporting club in the world, some would argue. And those six championship trophies sit there as you walk into practice every day. The same staff who helped the teams win six championships sit there every day. And it's an amazing place. And look, the crowd and the general public were so understanding of the rebuild because they knew how spoiled they'd been. I think you see some sporting fans around the world who expect success every year, and even no matter how well you've done, when it doesn't turn up, they're complaining. But the Chicago sporting fans were so patient with the rebuild because we were really bad. We were on track to be the worst team in the history of the game after they'd just won the championship the year before. But another wonderful city, an amazing basketball experience, and I suppose – I was there the 1 year. They wanted me to come back in the off season after my season, which would have meant foregoing the Sydney Olympics, which I wasn't prepared to do. And you know, a few people have told me it might have cost me another one, but I think if I was good enough, I would have gotten it without having to be there over the off season anyway. And I certainly wasn't prepared to give up a home Olympic Games for a maybe. So yeah, they were my 3 years in the NBA.
What was that like, the home Olympics? Everyone I've spoken to on this program and sports people I've spoken to over the years have just said what a buzz it was. It was a buzz for us to be involved in. It must have been incredible for you.
Just walking into that opening ceremony.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you're in that holding in the small arena for a few hours. It's a long day. But walking in there to those 110,000, last team out as a host nation, it was out of this world. It was just amazing.
Was it even more special because Gacy had the flag?
We're up the front near him. It probably was to some extent because basketball was in the front of everyone's mind because Andrew was carrying the flag and you know, we got to be a part of that as well. But, again, it's a little bit like childbirth. You can't explain it to someone who's never had a child. And as many words as I could throw at you right now, it's just really indescribable. It's something that unless you were there, it was amazing.
And yet 4 years later, an Olympic Games provided you with one of your disappointments because injury kept you out.
No, I did. And I'd learned well and truly by then that you never take anything for granted. And that was, I was gutted. I couldn't watch it. I went on holidays when the Olympics run. I couldn't bring myself to watch it. I mean, I said before, I don't do losing well. I just couldn't get my head around not being there. And so went away and, you find out the results and you speak to people, but couldn't sit through a game and watch. But, by the time Beijing came around, I honestly didn't think I was going to make the team. I'd had a couple of good seasons in the NBL, but you know, Nathan Jawai was coming through and these good young kids were coming through. And I met with Brian Gorgian, who was a coach, and he sort of said, look, and I said, okay, you don't, Gorge, you don't have to pick me. You know, we've had a relationship for a decade and a half. And I said, just tell me. And he said, I actually want you on the team. I said, who doesn't? And he said, no, that's not the point, but you're not going to play. I said, I need you there to almost be a conduit between the playing group and me. I need to know what's going on. I need to be able to get messages back to the group without being in their face the whole tournament. And so I almost came on in that role. And as it turned out, I ended up playing 20-something minutes a game and had one of the best tournaments of my life. Mm-hmm. We didn't get done what we needed to get done because we dropped a game early in the piece. But, personally, it was a great way to go out, you know, playing for Australia and... again, another experience, probably because of that and the larger role I had to what I had in Sydney, was another amazing experience.
You mentioned the name Brian Gorgian. He has been such an influential figure in Australian basketball. Is he the most influential figure in your career, coaching-wise?
Easily. He taught me things in and around work rate and in and around belief and all the goal-setting things, but they weren't just words. And a lot of people have asked me why he was the best coach. And I didn't figure it out till years later, but he had the ability to make every single person around him feel like the most important person in the world. And then once you felt like that, you'd do anything for him and you'd do anything for each other. And that was a really powerful thing. I think a lot of coaches get it the wrong way around, where they try to put a system in place before the players really know and trust you. But everyone knew and trusted Gorge implicitly. They knew that he cared about them as people. And because of that, as athletes, you know, whatever he wanted, you did. And that was grueling, but you knew that it was going to help you.
So in your coaching career, did you draw on those sort of qualities that you experienced with him to try and translate that into your personality as well?
Well, I would have liked to have. It was quick. And again, it's the hardest part of a professional coaching career is everyone always says you got to get through the first contract. And that didn't happen for me. But
why? Why didn't it happen?
Probably you have to ask the club that. But we had a pretty significant difference of opinion in the way you treated people, where they were very analytical or statistically driven and very analytical and wanted to get the right processes done on paper, where I believe that statistics can tell you any story you like. You need to make sure you treat people right. And we had a few clashes over the way that you needed to treat people and the type of chances you need to give people in and around behaviour and things like that. So Look, at the end, it you know, as disappointing as it was to be removed from the position, it was, it gave me time to go away and really try to redefine what I am as a coach. I still coach Caulfield Grammar. I still do coach, you know, various coaching, or still take up various coaching opportunities. But it's easy to go away and reinvent yourself now. So, you know, the coach I will be in my next full-time coaching job is probably very different than what I was as coach of the Melbourne Tigers.
I would imagine that if you get the flick, no matter how much self-belief you've got, you question yourself at times. Did you do that when that period happened?
Yeah, look, I was very comfortable in the fact that I stood by everything I'd told the players. And I think the most disappointing thing for me was I'd promised players some things that by not being there I couldn't then go and deliver. And they were things not even on a basketball court, but things for the players' families and the opportunities we'd be able to give and, you know, places we wanted to take their careers. And to me, it's that. I think, you know, my most enjoyable moments as a coach are, you know, a few, but having someone realise that they're better than what they thought they were, and, you know, even having the young players come back. When you finish coaching, I remember when you told me this, and I only got it, you know, 2 years later, and I've been able to. It's really pleasing. And, you know, for me, you know, probably as much as anyone, I still really, really smile every time I see Chris Golding put on an Australian singlet, because he was out of work and he didn't have a job in the NBL when the Gold Coast Blaze went under. You know, Mark Worthington, Anthony Petrie and Adam Gibson all got jobs and Chris Golding missed out. And, you know, we really rolled the dice. But I remembered being up in the Gold Coast and training against him after I'd retired one day. I remember thinking, God, this kid's good. He's just got something about him. And when I got the job and heard he was available, I just went after him, and we released one of our imports, which was a hard thing to do without him ever having a practice session for me. But, you know, we gave Chris an opportunity, and he took it and he ran. And he was the hardest working player I've had in my time as a professional coach. I found out, you know, he was paying the security guard at Hisense Arena $100 to get in there early and open the stadium for him so he could come and get extra work done before games. And that's the sort of person he is. So to go from not having a job to 2 years later getting within a millimetre of an NBA contract and, you know, wearing an Australian jersey consistently now, I'm just rapt for him.
We've talked about your time in Australia. We've talked about your time in America. When we come back on the other side of the break, we'll talk about your time in other parts of the world and the difficulty that may have caused being in a place like Russia. Our special guest on This Is Your Sporting Life is Chris Anstey, and we are here for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
Anstey with a big foul. Crowd don't like it. Oh, there's unsportsmanlike.
Here we go.
It was on, and it was Reece Carter, and it was Game 3 of the 2009 Grand Final Series. Chris Anstey is our special guest on This Is Your Sporting Life. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives, what happened there? You're such a gentle, mild-mannered fella. What was going on there?
We were flat, and we were down, and it was getting niggling, and, you know, someone had to take a stand, and, you know, didn't think it was worthy of an ejection. But if you run through someone with your shoulder after they've run into you already, I think you're entitled. I think big guys get punished a little bit because little guys fall down when you hit them, where we don't fall down when they hit us. So, they got it. They kicked me out of the game. They won that one. We came back and won Game 4 on our home floor, and they got us again to win the series. But yeah, we needed to try to find a way to swing momentum because we certainly weren't playing well that game, and then they were out, you know, outworking us. And in retrospect, maybe not the best way, or if it was the best way, maybe I didn't execute it as well as I possibly could have. But no, you got to take a stand sometimes.
Those titles you won at home, are they as proud as you are of anything in your career?
Yeah, they are, because, you know, one of the things, and, you know, I know we're going to mention Russia, but we won a European championship in Russia, and it was so big we had a public holiday. It was huge. First European title of any sport that a Russian team had won since it entered into the EU. But you go home after the celebrations, you sit in a two-bedroom apartment by yourself, and you go to training the next day, and you don't share it with anyone. And I think, you know, when you're good at something, you want to be able to share that with your family and friends. And I think for that reason, more than anything, the ability to come home to finish my career and have a really successful 4 years where we won 2 championships and fell 1 game short of the other two, it was really special because, again, you win the championship and 2 minutes later you're with your family, your friends, your kids. It's just different and, really, really special.
So here you are in Russia playing there. As you said, great achievements, but nobody to share it with. You've got the language barrier. You're sitting in a hotel room or an apartment somewhere. Did you ever get to the stage where you think, what am I doing here?
Quickly. You try to justify why you go and give the politically correct. They pay you a hell of a lot of money. I mean, I went for the money. It was simple as that, and it was a hell of a challenge. And, I got to Christmas year one. I'd been there since October, and it's minus 45 degrees outside. I'm sitting in a room by myself, and it's dark at 4 in the afternoon. And yeah, I've done the wrong thing. I don't know if I can get through another 6 months of this. One of the best things that happened in my first year in Russia was one of my old Dallas Mavericks teammates, Martin Mercep, Estonian guy, who was a good mate of mine, signed for our club just after Christmas. And he spoke both English and Russian and really, really helped me. Just had someone to hang out with outside of training, had someone to show me around. Just made things easier. And so I got through that first year and, I got on that plane and literally looked back. I'm never coming back here. And Martin called me 2 months later. He said, I know you said you're not coming back, but I'm moving to Kazan, going to play for Unix. He said they wanted me to call you and see if you'd come as well. I said, no. He said, they got money. So I'm sure they do. How much? And he said, $400,000 after tax. I said, I'm still not interested. 450. They just kept going. And they finally got to a number. I'll see you on Monday, mate. I went back, and the next 2 years, by comparison, were easy. I made a lot of money. We had great success. I suppose as much as anything, though, you grow up really quickly and you learn to almost survive without that safety net around you because it's just you. And you don't have your support crew around you. You don't have your physio. You don't have your family. If something goes bad, you got to figure it out for yourself. If you're bored off the court or something's not right in your life, you have to turn up and play because they'll send you home on the first flight if you don't. And you don't want to mess with them because you're kind of getting an understanding of who owns the clubs and you don't want to do the wrong thing by them. So, an amazing 3 years where I learnt more about myself than any other 3 years of my life, and probably because I was mid to late 20s then and a little bit more mature, but so much of what I learnt in Russia I was able to bring back as a different basketball player and person when I came back and played in Melbourne. And I think without those 3 years, I certainly wouldn't have had the success that I had back in Australia because it just toughened me up.
Sounds like a glamorous existence, travelling the world, playing the sport that you love doing, but it can take a pretty heavy toll on your personal life.
Yeah, it does, and you're right. It's you're away a lot. You see amazing places. Since I've retired, there are so many. I've been to so many places around the world, but I haven't seen any of them. I reckon I've only actually had the chance to experience 10% of the places I've actually visited because your plane, your bus, your hotel, your stadium, you're back to the airport again. So there are so many places. We drove by Prague one day. You're just looking at a skyline and then you're playing an hour and a half away. You drive back past it the next afternoon and that's Prague. It's a place I'd love to go. But you do sacrifice it. Life goes on at home without you. And, if you're home for 2 months after being away for 10, you see everyone once, maybe twice, and then you're gone again. And you fall out of that weekly, monthly, whatever routine, mates get into and families get into. So it took a while when I got back and I actually remember, I'd been back a month and we had a whole bunch of people come over for a birthday party and I was so used to for the 3 years not understanding anything and just being almost present in my own head and didn't matter what else was going on around me. And all of a sudden we've got 50 people in a room talking, yelling, singing, music. I had to leave. It was too much. It was almost like an information overload where I heard every single conversation. I had to walk in a room by myself and sit there I felt stupid doing it, and someone walked in, what are you doing? And I said, it's too much. And they've looked at me like, what happened to you in the last 3 years? But it takes a while to integrate yourself back into Australian culture and back into a routine where you're seeing your friends and family a lot. And just the ability to have conversations was amazing. And the things that you take for granted that you know, the first road trip of with the Melbourne Tigers pre-season we went on, we went to Millicent and we stayed at one of those Motel Sixes or whatever the little B&Bs are on the side of the road, and every single person was complaining. And it was a horrible place, but it was the best place I'd stayed in 3 years. I couldn't have been happier. I understood the ladies. I understood the lady at reception. The bed was comfortable and clean. It was amazing. And my perception in that regard had just changed as well, that, you know, I just wasn't going to complain about anything ever again.
A last question on your time in Russia, Chris. Did you develop a taste for vodka or some of that beautiful
vodka
Russian food?
Vodka got me through a lot of nights. It's because, again, if you're bored and, you know, you're not supposed to say that as an athlete, but, God, you get home at 4 p.m. and there's nothing on television. Back then, keeping no pay TV, no social media, none of that. You know, Amazon was my best friend. But if I was waiting on box sets of TV shows or movies, you had nothing to watch. And so you found a few. You know, Martin and I'd go get a bottle of vodka. And we'd play a card game or we'd do something, and you know, we'd get through the rest. And days off were, you didn't want days off because you were just bored. It was tricky. But again, we got through and we had some success. And I'll tell you, you know, there have been 6 or 7 Australian players go to Russia since, and it felt good to open the doors because it's a wonderful experience.
We'll take our final break and then we'll talk about fatherhood, we'll talk about Caulfield Grammar, and we'll talk about the future for Chris Anstey, who is our special guest on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
Listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
And I hope you're enjoying the chance to celebrate the life of Chris Anstey here on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals. We mentioned Hunter before. We heard Hunter before. How's fatherhood again?
Fatherhood's great. It's, you know, he's 5.5 months old. I think you slow down a bit and you enjoy some of the smaller moments. You're not in quite as much of a rush when you get a little bit older. So, as you're well aware, I'm here today and I've had to bring him in because I wasn't going to leave him at home, obviously. But, look, I love it. He's got an older brother and older sister who love him to bits, and they're old enough already that they can look after him. So we've got babysitters built in. Everyone loves him, and he's, you know, his mum's a mum for the first time, and she's an amazing mother, and it's just created a, you know, an even stronger family. So it's been fantastic.
Would you encourage your kids as they grow up to get involved in sport?
My daughter's already playing for the state, playing basketball. My son plays ice hockey, which was out of left field, but you know, you just never know where they're going to go. But the answer is always yes, and it's not for the achievements you get through it. It's for the secondary group of friends outside of school. It's the lessons you learn from winning and losing, and it's just the ability to remain active and not in front of a screen. There are so many reasons you should play sport, and that there are levels in every sport that you can participate in. And you know, winning a premiership or winning a game at your level is just as special, no matter what your level. Or watch your sport. So absolutely, I'd encourage every child to be a part of a sporting team or club, because yeah, it becomes a social epicenter for your community as well. It's where people get together, and it's, you know, some great memories had.
Will it be a hindrance to them that they will carry the Anstey name or the Frame name throughout their lives? Look, will people expect more of them because of that?
Look, I don't know. And, you know, my daughter gets it a little bit playing basketball. But, look, it's a conversation we can have. And I think I'll be the last one to know if it's affecting them. You know, you hear people like Tim Watson speak about he didn't realise that Job was affected by the fact that he got sacked as St Kilda coach. And, you know, Ethan, my son, came home one night in tears, and he said people kept saying you got fired. And I said, that's fine. I did. But, and so he wanted to, you know, the kids at school were picking on him when I got, and you don't realise. It affects them, and they know that, you know, if you're walking down the street and people point you out or want to chat to you, they kind of realise that being 7 foot tall, you do stand out and you're a little bit different because you've done something that people are aware of. But no, look, they enjoy it, and I hope they like having me as a dad.
Well, I'm sure they do, and you get some great moments from your kids, but you also get some great moments from other kids as well. I mentioned Caulfield Grammar. You've been involved there for a long time. You must derive a great deal of pleasure seeing young people succeed
in
their chosen
endeavour. I love working with people who want to go somewhere else and get better, and that's it. Whatever sport, and at Caulfield, I've got the privilege of coaching students aged anywhere or anywhere between year 8 and year 12 kids, and they've got one thing in common. They want to improve. They want to see where they can get to. And I think if you ask any athlete who the biggest influence of their career was, they'll nominate someone in the window between probably year 11 and second year university when they're really starting to form who they are as a person. And to have a small role and perhaps even have a small influence on some of the people at that age is... There's a big responsibility, but there's a great deal of enjoyment. And I know what sport's given me, and all I wish for anyone who plays basketball in a team that I coach is they get to experience some of the enjoyment that I did, but it's not easy to get there. So I'd like to help guide them and show them what it does take to get there, because the results and the rewards when you do are amazing.
And finally, I'll just push an imaginary crystal ball in front of you. And in 10 years' time, where do you see basketball in Australia?
I see it thriving. I do, and I don't say that because I was a harshest critic 3 or 4 years ago, but there's a realisation that I think it's bottomed out. I think the basketball public of Australia has realised that it was fragile and it might not be here forever, so they do need to get on board and support it. And, you know, as a Western Bulldogs fan, I remember when the club nearly folded. Geez, it's that close to folding. I'd better become a member, and I've been a member every day since. And I think basketball got there a few years back, and it needs some stability. It needs some continued success, but I think it's in a good place. And again, you mentioned before, if we can have some of the legends of the sport come back and be front and centre and help promote and be a part of the decision-making of the sport, then it'll be in a pretty good place.
Make no mistake about it, you're a legend of the sport here in Australia. It's been great to be able to sit down and spend an hour with you and go over some of the wonderful achievements that you've had in your career. Chris Anstey, it's been a delight to chat to you.
I appreciate that. Thanks for having me.
Chris Anstey joining us on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funeral, Celebrating Lives. Catch us same place, same time, next Sunday, right here on 1116 SEN.